Was your life harder or easier once you got that big payday from selling Twitch?
I mean, it was easier from a, like, I don't have to do as much of the stuff that I don't like to do way. But it wasn't really any different from the, you know, there's ups and downs every day. You know, there's things you're always going to not like in the world, no matter how you try to eliminate them. And then it's easy. Once you get this payday, it's like, oh, what's the next payday? What's the payday after that? And you're worried about the future, because worrying about the future is part of the human condition, right? So even though you think that, like, oh, if you just got X, you'll be fine forever, like, that becomes normalized, and then it's just, now how do I get 2X or 10X or whatever?
Yeah, you climb the mountain, then you realize you get to the top. Oh, there's
Another peak over there.
several ranges ahead I've
Exactly.
got to climb.
And the only way is to get off the treadmill and say, oh, okay, that's cool, and I can have goals, I can continue walking, but maybe that's not the whole world. Maybe the whole world is not, if I get to that next mountain or the mountain after that, maybe it's just about this moment right now.
When he was a kid, Justin Kahn's mom told him that he could do anything in life as long as he did it well. And that laid the foundation for the path he's been on since his early 20s. As a child, Kahn says that he was inspired by his entrepreneur parents, who would tell them that he wanted to be the CEO when he grew up, even though he didn't really know what that meant. While his path to get there hasn't been all conventional, and for a time included him broadcasting a 24-hour live stream of his own life in the days of Justin TV, the Twitch co-founder seems to have gotten his wish. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Element. Some of you know I've been battling migraines for a while, and my doctor hasn't found any solutions for me. I was so sick of taking medicine, so I talked to several pro athlete friends and their trainers, who told me I was probably dehydrated and missing important electrolytes. I Googled electrolytes and did more research and found this amazing drink, which is packed full of essential minerals like magnesium, potassium, and sodium. In over a 30-day period, I saw my headaches decrease by about half. I'm hooked, so I reached out to the folks at Element headquarters, and now we're working together to help more of you. Electrolyte deficiency is real. I experienced it myself, and the imbalance can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, and weakness. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. For those of you fasting, doing intermittent fasting, or just working out a lot, electrolytes can make the difference between feeling great and feeling like garbage. When you sweat, the primary electrolyte lost is sodium. Athletes can lose up to 7 grams per day. Anyway, I drink one mixed with about 10 ounces of water before working out in the morning, and the other one later after dinner to hydrate for the next day. Want to try a free sample pack? Go to drinkelement.com/BrianElliott, and they'll send you all the flavors to try. Shipping's just $5. That's drinkelement.com/Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Elliott, E-L-L-I-O-T-T, and get all the latest flavors. Okay, now let's get into the episode with Justin Kahn.
My name is Justin Kahn. I'm an investor and entrepreneur, and you're watching Behind the Brand with Brian Elliott.
Hey everyone, I'm Brian Elliott. Welcome to another episode of Behind the Brand. Justin, welcome to sunny Southern California.
It's amazing here, thank you.
Thanks for coming to one of these amazing houses that we get access to. Thanks to our friend Aaron. But I usually ask my guests, how did you get this job?
How did I get the job? I guess I just kind of fell into it. That's probably what most people say, I assume. Or they, like, maybe they were very strategic. But for me, it was definitely the tripping into it. I became an entrepreneur right out of college. That was 15 years ago, when I started a company when I was in my senior year of school. And it was kind of like Google Calendar. It had all the features of Google Calendar, but it was worse than Google Calendar in every way. I mean, we were undergrad, so you have to forgive us. We launched this calendar app, and we got funded to pursue it as a startup by this firm called Y Combinator.
Give us some context. What year is this?
Yeah, so I was at Yale University in 2005, and Gmail had just come out, and it was really cool. It was the first application, web application, that really highlighted what you could do with JavaScript and you know, on the internet, making a powerful app, just like someone would download an app, you know, install it. But this one you just opened on your web browser and it worked, and it was this really cool email client. And so we thought, hey, there should be a calendar that's like this, you know, an online calendar that where you can drag and drop appointments, stuff like that, make it super simple.
Well, can I also point out 2005, this is another kind of milestone year. This is when YouTube first launched.
Right.
This is the year YouTube came out.
I don't think I had seen YouTube yet when we started working on our app.
Yeah.
And so we worked on this app and we launched it. Well, first we got funded. We worked on this app all our senior year, and then we heard about this firm called Y Combinator that was funding startups. And we were like, well, we have a startup. So we applied to this nascent firm. It was their first batch ever. They were going to fund a bunch of startups, and the startups were going to come work out of their office in Cambridge for the summer. Not really work out of their office, but like work in Cambridge out of the summer. Yeah. And then we would get to launch, and they would give us some funding, and hopefully that created some startups. And so we applied to this program and got in through, you know, kind of the skin of our teeth. They didn't like the idea at first, actually, but then we convinced them on it.
How did you hear about Y Combinator in the first place?
My friend of mine, who was in the computer science department at Yale, got an email. Paul Graham, the founder of Y Combinator, had emailed all of these different computer science departments around the country saying, I'm funding technology startups from students. And so he was like, oh, my friend has a startup. He emailed it to Emmett and I, my co-founder. And we were like, oh, let's apply. This guy's funding startups. We have a startup.
Yeah, yeah. Just to put another timestamp on that. So a lot of things are happening at that time, even in that area. So you have the year before, 2004, Mark basically comes out with Facebook in that sort of, you know, Cambridge area, let's say. So things are happening. Sparks are flying.
Yeah, people are starting companies. There's like this kind of wave of companies that come up in that 2004 to 2006 era that now today are, you know, real big companies.
Yeah, shortly after that, we will hear...
Dropbox was, you know, one of them.
Dropbox, Twitter is right on the heels of that, So this is like a big sort of like...
It's kind of in those like 2007, 2008.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time.
Yeah. So we're, you know, but it doesn't feel exciting, right? Because all these startups are like super nascent, right? And there's not really that culture around startups that there is today where people want to start, you know, they want to go to the big technology companies, they want to start startups. It hadn't really started then. This was just the beginning. So we got our start and applied to Y Combinator and went to interview with them and convinced them to fund our company. And then that's kind of how we got our very first push to like do this as a career.
So was it like a seed round or is it an A round? Like what stage was it?
Yeah, it was, I guess you would call it a seed round back then, but now you would call it like a pre-seed round. It was, Paul called us, we interviewed in Cambridge, went to their office, interviewed. They mostly thought that rich JavaScript applications on the internet weren't gonna work. And so we spent the whole time arguing about how like this was the future and people were gonna use these like heavy client-side apps. And if we were like, we didn't know how we did. We left walking around Cambridge, and a couple hours later they called us and said, hey, we want to fund your company. And so they wanted to invest $12,000 in the company, which seemed like a ton to me at the time. It was like, that's a lot.
Yeah, hey, we can live, you know, rent-free for...
Yeah, for months.
You know, half a year, whatever.
Exactly. So we raised that $12,000 from them. And so I don't know if you call that a seed round, but then...
Brutal.
At the end of Y Combinator, we raised another... $50,000.
I think that's called birdseed round, right?
Like, but that was enough for us, me and my co-founder. We didn't have a lot of expenses, like you said. So we were literally eating burritos every day. And then we got started.
Yeah. Okay. So you get sort of a taste of the good life. You know, people are having confidence in you. They're saying yes to your ideas. You're getting this, you know, elevator pitch experience where you're pitching to people with money. Even though it's maybe five figures.
Right, five figures, not the six or seven.
Six, seven, eight, or nine yet.
Yeah, we got to work our way up.
And so where did you go from there?
So we go to this program, right? We raise our angel round. The whole summer, we're in the batch with guys like Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian from Reddit, right? And other founders. There's like about eight companies, all young. And we're working on these different ideas. And every week we'd go and show people what we built that week, right? We'd like show our batchmates, like, here's what I built. And like, it's, you know, people would be like, oh, that's cool. And it was a lot of programmers. So there was a lot of trading engineering tips and stuff like that. And then we launched our product, like a first version of our product at the end of the summer. The first version was terrible, but that was enough to raise that $50,000 kind of seed round, whatever. And we did that. And then we worked on the product for the next year and a half. Well, a year and like 14 months, worked on the product, and it wasn't that good. Mm-hmm. We launched it. We launched a second version, which was better, but the second version was like, it was like better, but it wasn't as good as Google Calendar. And Google Calendar came out like the next month.
Okay.
And so that kind of murdered our infantile startup.
Do you think that there was like people watching what you were doing? Like, was there a mole and they were sort of reporting back? Or is it kind of like the movie business where, you know, like, everyone kind of knows, okay, there's going to be like this disaster movie, and then everyone kind of creates their disaster movie. Right. Or there's going to be a show, a dating show,
yeah,
and then all the networks have a dating show.
I think it's kind of like that, right? Where
word gets out.
Well, it's more obvious that, like, if you have an email, you would want calendar with it, right? That's like Outlook on the desktop was bundled email and calendar. So it didn't take a rocket scientist to be like, oh, the web version is going to have a calendar component, right? So the web version of email. So we talked to all these guys. We talked to Yahoo about selling to them. We talked to Google. Google actually brought us in. It was kind of like that scene from Silicon Valley. We come in, and then they're all on their laptops, and they're just like asking us questions about what we did, and they're like writing everything down.
Right.
And then we're like, oh, do you guys want to do something? We're hoping they'll like buy the company or something. And they're just like, oh, okay, we'll call you. And then like the next month, the Google Calendar comes out. They are obviously already building it.
Yeah.
But it was funny how like they just kind of, they were just interested in learning everything, and then that's it.
Interesting. That's do you have, make those guys sign NDAs or anything? Or?
They don't sign NDAs, right? Yeah. You want to talk to Google, you got to go in there and you sign an NDA.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
So you take the risk of someone stealing your idea, potentially.
The thing is like, they already were working on that idea. There was like 30 competitors that came out in that year of different companies that were building web calendars. I don't even remember the names. One was called 30 Boxes, and then there was like all these different other calendar companies, because it was a very obvious idea.
Maybe they're looking at you like, is yours better than ours?
Exactly. They were like,
should we acquire Justin instead of...
Yeah.
So they can cherry pick that way too.
Yeah, and Yahoo actually was interested. Paul Graham from Y Combinator had sold his company to Yahoo. It was called ViaWeb in the first .com boom. And he set up a meeting, and they were actually interested in acquiring us. So they brought us in, we're talking to them. They're like, okay, we're interested in buying the company. They did this whole interview with us, and they actually liked us as programmers, surprisingly, even though we were pretty bad programmers. And then at the end of the interview, or like the next couple, like a month later, this guy from Yahoo calls me, who's like the corporate dev guy, and he's like, oh, I want to buy your company. And we were like, oh my God, you know, we're 22 years old or whatever. So we're like, yeah, I'm here for it, yeah. And he's like, okay, how much do you guys want? And I was thinking, I want $1 million for myself, $1 million for Emmett. So I said, okay, like $2 million. And he's like, 1 million. No, like no beats skipped. He's like, how about $1 million? And I'm like, yes, sold.
Oh.
You know, I just folded like a house of cards, like dominoes, went over easy. And he's like, okay, I'm gonna paper this deal. It's gonna take me a day or two, and I'll call you back. I'm gonna email you.
Okay.
And then I just never heard from him again.
Okay, so you were thrilled at the beginning, and then he ghosted you.
He just straight ghosted us. Years later, I found out what happened, but then, you know, that was my first experience with corp dev in Silicon Valley.
Interesting. And so what was your takeaway lesson from that? Like, your feelings were hurt, maybe, or you were bummed out, you didn't have a payday.
We were kind of depressed. We were a little depressed about it. Paul Graham always said this thing, deals fall through. So what he meant is if, you know, all sorts of deals, whether it's funding, acquisitions, they fall through, you can't count on them. So you have to bring that mindset with you.
People talk big talk.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I want it. But then
when it comes down to it, they aren't anywhere to be found.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up until the cash lands in your account.
Exactly. When the cash is in the bank, that's when it's done.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Okay. So where'd you go from there?
So we were depressed. We're working on this app. It's not a very good app. Eventually we're like, I want to get out of this business because we don't know what we're doing, and no one was using our app. And so every day we'd go over to our friends, the Reddit guy's apartment. Like this is in the summer, a year after we'd started.
Alexis
and Steve, you know, who they're famous now. They're like, one's running Reddit, the other's like a famous investor, married to Serena Williams, you know, like but back then they're just like two guys that we know, right?
Yeah.
So, and Reddit, it's like people are using it, but not that many people, right?
Yeah, it was like on the fringe for sure. Yeah.
So we're going over to their house every day and just playing video games like on their couch because we don't know what to do. Our app's not working. And eventually, I'm like, Emmett, we can't keep doing this. We got to sell the company or something. We got to get out of this company, and maybe I'll go back and get a job or like whatever. We had jobs lined up before that we quit or we pre-quit. We never showed up to them to do the startup, but then now it's like not looking good, right?
Let's go back in the timeline just a little bit. Like so, for young Justin. What were you thinking? What did you want to be when you grew up? Were you thinking about, like, I want to be an astronaut, or I want to play Major League Baseball, or... Like...
Yeah, well, I think Emmett and I both, we always wanted to be entrepreneurs, you know, because both our parents were entrepreneurs.
Okay, I was going to ask, yeah.
I remember my mom asked me once, and I was like, oh, I want to be a CEO when I grow up. I didn't really know what a CEO did, but, like, that was my mind, you know, my mentality. So
in charge of something.
In charge of something, yeah. had a lot of ego tied into it, which, you know, will factor in later in the story.
Did your parents have an influence on that? Like, were they like pushing you to, like, did you have a tiger mom? It's like,
she was a tiger mom in her own way. I think my mom was always, she always thought if you're doing something, you should do your best. You should apply yourself the most, which I think is, you know, it's a one attitude. I think there's a lot of good in it, which is to like get out there and apply yourself, but it's hard to do things for fun then, right? Like to do things purely for joy.
Right. You don't know where to prioritize. If you're doing 1,000 things, you can't do 1,000 things your best, right?
Exactly. And so, but that rubbed off on me. And so I was like, oh, I want to do my best and I want to be the best, right? And so with entrepreneurship, it was always like, oh, I need to have the biggest company. I need to like raise the most money. I need to like have the most employees. All this kind of mental overhead that I was putting on myself, a lot of weight.
Did they warn you about having like a backup plan? Like, hey, if this doesn't work, you know, we want you to go into finance or...
No, my parents weren't that. They, as long as I got educated, you know, I went to Yale, good school, they were pretty much like, you should do it. They weren't tiger mom in the traditional sense of being like, go be a doctor or lawyer.
Right, there was no...
They were more like, you should go and do what you want as long as it's something that you're applying your best to, you know.
Yeah. I ask that with context because I think a lot of people who watch this show...
Yeah.
I think it's super sound advice, and I think it tracks, I think it's pretty timeless, and that is you really have to consider the source, right? Like, so if you're, whoever's giving you advice, you know, your parents or your friends or family member, whoever's giving you advice, you have to consider the context or, you know, framework from which they see the world.
Yeah.
So if, you know, if, let's say if, you know, life has come easy for them, they might give you that perspective. The reverse is true, right? Like if they're, let's say a boomer came out of World War II,
yeah,
you know, they had to ration their food or, you know, give all their metal to the military to build airplanes or whatever. That's a different mindset, right? That's what do they call that? A scarcity mindset, right? Versus the abundance mindset. So I'm always curious about that because I think we have to be careful.
Yeah, my mom had a scarcity mindset, right? Because she grew up in a very poor country. She grew up in Malaysia, Chinese immigrant to Malaysia. They were very poor. And so she had that scarcity mindset where, you know, she was actually made really good money, her and my dad in their lives. But she had that mindset of like, oh, it's not enough, you know? And so...
Or you never know when it's going to get taken from you.
So for me, there was... I kind of had that feeling of like, oh, it's not enough. Yeah. And even after... You know, we became successful, there was that feeling of scarcity.
Yeah, I've heard you talk a little bit about that on your channel. I'd like to unpack that a little bit more. So take us now to the next sort of event in the timeline. You want to get out of the company. You're thinking about getting a regular job maybe, or what's your plan B?
So there was no real plan B. It was like, I'm going to move back to Seattle, move back with my parents. And what I did was I ended up selling, we said, how can we get the money back for investors? The, you know, 50 grand we raised. And so we ended up listing the company on eBay as a last minute Hail Mary to just recoup some of the money.
Were these investors friends or were they like?
They were like friends of Paul's. So Paul invested money and then he got some of his friends, he corralled them to invest.
So there was some emotional attachment.
Well, it was more like I took money. I considered that, you know, a sacred responsibility. So I was like, I want to pay them back, and so they took a chance on me. So that's why we decided to take this flyer.
Yeah, unlike the stories I've heard of many other startups that just burn through. I mean, they spend $1 million on hats and T-shirts or something, and it's like, oh well, you know, that's gone. But
we didn't. Yeah, we took it seriously. So we ended up listing this company on eBay, like the website, all the code and stuff, and we said we're going to sell it, and we ended up actually getting bids. And the day of the auction was going to expire, you know, we got bids, and it started off at 50,000, which was our reserve price. Then it went up to like 85, and I was like, oh shit! And then it went up to like 100, and 113, 150, and as I'm clicking refresh on this eBay page, it just goes all the way up to 258,000.
Wow!
And I'm like, oh. Wow, we're like, at that point, we make a little bit of money. Emmett and I made some money, and it was, you know, that was a good feeling.
Yeah, I wonder, was that the first ever sort of eBay auction of a company like that?
Well, so it wasn't. I often get credited for it, but, you know, to be completely honest, like, someone else had sold their company on eBay for $105,000 the year before.
Okay.
And I just copied their idea.
Okay. Yeah. Well, but you know, there's something to that, right? Yeah. To follow the model, and you guys sold it for more than double that last record. You beat the record.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that made me convinced that entrepreneurship wasn't all bad. And then from there, that's kind of how we started the next company. Paul asked us, like, he was like, do you have any other ideas? I'd love to fund you again. So we walked into his house, you know, a couple weeks after we closed the sale of the last company. We walk in and we're saying, hey, we got this idea for, we pitched this idea for like a software to lay out your online content as like a coffee table book. And then you could sell it to your fans.
Okay.
And he was like, he had content online, but he's like, I hate that idea. He's like, I'd never use it. You know, print is the past. Like, yeah. And so I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, what other ideas do you have? And I said, we have this idea for Justin TV, which is this idea we thought of when we were trying to sell Kiko. We were having all these business conversations that we thought were interesting.
And what year is this?
2006 now, 1 year later.
Yeah, so it's not that far ahead. You know, YouTube is just basically out of
just sold for $1.7 billion or whatever.
Yeah, so it's just out of the gate.
Yeah.
Or it's just getting on people's radar. I remember I was at the studio at the time.
Yeah.
And I was like,
there's something there.
Well, that was actually, for me, the signal that the playing field was going to be level at some point.
Yeah.
Because up to that point, you know, I had watched, so I was at Universal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could see from my office, you know, Steven Spielberg's office, the Amblin, you know, little office down there where he made E.T. and Jaws and, you know, basically.
Whose office was higher? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I was in this tower on Lancashire. It was like a 30-something story. It's an iconic building.
Yeah.
But Spielberg's office is where all the magic happened, and everybody knows that.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, Universal built, you know, their whole program around Steven, but, you know, and then J.J. Abrams and all these other directors, and there was gatekeepers.
Yeah.
I had sort of fallen into production. I was on the home entertainment side working with movies on DVD and eventually video on demand, and we, you know, as an industry, we went back into the studio to create original content.
Yeah.
So we'd be sitting across from someone like De Niro and you know, talking about deep catalog movie like Raging Bull, where he was a boxer. And we'd be like, so what'd you eat for breakfast? What was your morning routine, right? And record like the alternative endings and bloopers. And so I got sort of the bug like, hey, production is pretty fun.
Yeah.
And at some point I think I want to be a creator, not just a marketer talking about strategy and, you know, all that.
Yeah.
But when YouTube launched, I was like, okay, something's happening. I felt this change, you know, in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was the time. That was the era.
Very exciting.
So we walk into his house and we're like, you know, he was asking us, do you have any other ideas? He didn't like our first idea. And I said, I have this idea for Justin TV, which is us trying to create our own 24/7 live reality show on the internet.
Yeah. Now, there weren't really any cameras either, right, at that time. I mean, not like there are now, like the DSLR movement or...
No, there was no cam. There weren't digital cameras in that same way. There was like a flip cam, which had come out.
I still have mine.
Yeah, people were making YouTube videos with that, but there weren't, you know, you still had to like take your footage on, like, I don't think they were even SD cards. They were like, it was like an analog tape type of thing.
Yeah, I think you plugged it into your computer and then it was a download thing.
That whole thing was not super good, you know, that whole system. So we had to, like, in order to make this work, so we talk about, we sold the idea of Justin TV to them. They end up funding it. And
what was your budget for it?
Well, so we just started pitching them the idea. Like, Paul was there and his partner, Robert Morris, were there. And we're pitching them the idea, and they're like, let's they're into it, right? They start pitching it back to me. They're like, this could be a new wave of entertainment on the internet, new form of reality TV.
Was there anything else reality TV happening at the time? Like,
well, there was, this is right before like the Keeping Up with the Kardashians came out. I think that was like in 2008, right? Or something like that. There was more reality stars. My hunch with Justin TV was that people like watching people. They love following people.
Yeah.
And so there is an interest in following, like, who's the authentic person. And you could make someone famous if you just let them have access to those people in that way, like really deeply connected to what are they doing every life and in their lives. And that was born out, right, like with social media. We just had like kind of the wrong form factor because ours was like a 24/7 live stream.
One of the first vlogs, really.
It's kind of, like the first vlog.
Yeah. So you're like an OG, you're the pioneer, one of them.
Yeah, one of them, yeah. And so we basically walk out of there with a check for $50,000 because Robert Morris, who's a professor of computer science at MIT, was like, I'll fund that just to see you make a fool of yourself. And so then we were off to the races and we got started. And the biggest hurdle was to figure out the technical part of like, how do we do this? Because there weren't cameras. There wasn't like internet connections that were strong enough to carry the data.
Yeah, how did you do it?
Well, technically what we did was we took an analog camera, hooked it up to a computer to turn it into a webcam feed. It was like a computer I was wearing on my back. We made this system that had multiple cell phone modems on the different networks and could send the video in different, it broke up the stream into like multiple parts and then sent it over and then would reassemble it on the other side and then send it to the viewers.
I don't think people understand, or maybe they do. 2006, this is like a year before the first iPhone.
Yeah.
So there's like the bandwidth, there's like no bandwidth.
Yeah.
This is still like you're dialing up your internet, you know, that really terrible sound.
Yeah.
You know, web pages are still kind of loading slowly. This is like old school, terrible bandwidth, not even 3G, probably like 1G. I don't
know. It was a technically complicated problem to solve, yeah. For sure.
And so how much access? Was this fairly basically unscripted? Like,
It was unscripted, yeah. It was just me doing whatever.
And how much access did you decide to give to people? I mean,
we gave a lot. You know, we gave, really it was us just shooting everything. I was trying to shoot 24/7.
Yeah. Was there any forethought put into it? Like, was there like a script? Was there a plan? Was it just like...
So we scripted like 1 week's worth of content, yeah. And then we ran out and it was super boring because it was just me on my computer. You know, we launched in 2007, in March of 2007.
Yeah.
The first couple of weeks, days were scripted. When we launched, it actually, the TechCrunch announced our us early. They announced us at midnight on Sunday instead of at 9 a.m. And then they wouldn't take the product, the page back. So people started coming to the site and I was just sleeping. They wouldn't pull the article, right? Because it's already out there. And so the content was terrible. It was just me like living a life, right? And
yeah.
Like most of the time, I'm just like sitting on the couch working on our website or like, you know, doing nothing.
Yeah.
And so after a week, people were like, why, you know, go entertain us, like go do something. But they also said, hey, I want to create my own content. And so the light bulb kind of went off and we said, oh, we should let people create their own live stream. And then it became a platform for anyone to broadcast live.
So that was the seed. You had to sort of fail.
Yeah, we kind of had to fail at like making our own show to realize other people wanted to create shows and then create a whole platform for that.
Which turned into Twitch.
Yeah, so it turned into a platform for anyone to broadcast live video. We raised money for that, we grew that, we raised about $7 million for that, grew it to be a pretty big website in the world. And then it's flattened out, it stopped growing. And Twitch came out of an idea my co-founder Emmett had about like people want to watch other people play video games. That's what the content he wanted. You know, there was some skepticism inside the company on whether that would be big enough, but that was one of the ideas we had, and we started working on that idea, and eventually it became the Twitch you know today.
So I want to go back and talk a little bit about some of the obstacles that you had while you were playing Justin TV, because I'm sure, you know, you're still eating burritos or, you know, living on the low.
Yeah.
You weren't, you know, pimping, riding around in your Mercedes.
Yeah.
Was there ever a time you're thinking like, what am I doing? I'm wasting time.
All the time. I thought, what am I doing constantly.
Were other people saying, what are you doing? Why are you wasting so much time? Or,
well, you know, not really. My parents were very supportive. Like other people, you know, there was like, I went on the Today Show and Ann Curry on the Today Show was like, what are you doing? Like, what do you do? What do your parents think of this? You know?
I guess you did have funding though. So there was sort of proof of concept.
Yeah, we had funding and we thought there could be something here. And once we launched it as a live video site, like definitely people were using it. So there was some traction, right? The problem, like every, you know, entrepreneurship, the mindset's cyclical. So every year or so, I'd be like, oh, things are not going well. Like, should I be at a job? You know, yeah. Like.
And how are you measuring whether or not it was going well? Was it like engagement? Was it money?
It's kind of like engagement, money, how I was feeling, all those things. So there'd be ups and downs, you know, like startups are a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And so there'd be peaks where we're like, oh, traffic grew, raised more money, whatever, hired an employee we really wanted to hire. And there were a lot of valleys that were like, oh, traffic fell, the site went down, like we're, you know, someone quit. And it's always a balance of trying, like when you're in those lows, trying not to quit, you know.
Yeah. Were you getting much of a hit, like from little appearances on the Today Show? Was that?
No, so like the press and stuff did nothing, right? Like it was all about are you letting people create content that they want to share with other people?
Right. That's what I was thinking, is like the Today Show audience is not the Justin TV audience or the future Twitch audience.
No.
Yeah. So that's part of the disconnect, right? Like, right. if you hire a PR firm, they're like,
yeah, it's like useless.
We want to get you on.
Yeah, all that stuff is useless for growth, right? Growth strategies are very limited growth strategies, right? One is like you have customers who want to share, like users who want to share it, and so they bring the customers. That's kind of like what Twitch is.
You didn't dial up Alexis and get back into Reddit or anything? That would have been.
We tried to. I mean, we did some like. We try to do some stuff with Reddit, especially with Twitch, with the Reddit StarCraft community. StarCraft was the first game that we kind of grew with.
Yeah.
It was pretty strong, so we like tried to collaborate with them.
Yeah. Were you guys still tight from school, that Y Combinator era, or what's the camaraderie like?
Well, I mean, startups are very lonely, so you know, there were a lot of bonds with the founders that you know were early in YC that we went through around the same time. So the guys from Scribd, which is this like. You know, kind of like a Kindle and audiobook competitor.
Yeah.
There's a company called Weebly. They sold to Square. There's a company called Reddit. You know, there's Reddit. We were close to all of those guys in the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And still are today.
And people are willing and able to help where they can, right? Like, you know.
Exactly. It's like a cohort, right? So there's a lot of like, it's good to, if you're an entrepreneur, it's really good to make a cohort of your peers so that you can kind of go through things together and help each other. Because otherwise, entrepreneurship is a very lonely journey.
To me, one of the major golden nugget lessons here is that you had to sort of, I don't want to say fail, because what's that saying? You know, sometimes you win and sometimes you learn.
Yeah.
You were doing a ton of learning.
Exactly. I'm an expert at learning.
Right?
Yeah.
But you sort of had to, like in the eyes of other people, let's say, the perception, you had to sort of fail or not do that great in order to flesh out the bigger idea, which became Twitch, which was probably your payday.
Yeah.
That's a super important lesson, because, you know, maybe what other people say or maybe how you're measuring success, a lot of people quit too soon. I remember in high school, I read that book, that Napoleon Hill book, Think and Grow Rich. It's kind of a popular book among high school students, maybe college students.
Yeah.
And the one story that I remember from that book is the story of this gold miner in the late 1800s, the gold rush to California.
Yeah.
And they tell the story of this guy who came out and he was panning for gold and he had this mine and he was working at it and he was digging. I think he dug for, I don't want to say more than 5 years, but it seems like a long time he was digging. And he found nothing and he ultimately just gave up, abandoned the mine, left to try to find gold somewhere else. Someone else comes along, repopulates his mine, gets it going.
Yeah.
And within like 3 feet of digging, finds Sutter's Mill,
the
biggest gold mine in the history of the world. And so the lesson there is he quit too soon.
Yep.
And you never know when you're 3 feet from gold.
Yep.
I think that's true. And that's what kills startups, right? Is when people quit because they're burned out, they're discouraged, they don't know what else to do.
Yeah. So maybe impart some advice. How do we measure that? How do we know? It's so difficult, right?
So I think it's really hard to say. Like, obviously, there's a lot of survivorship bias in that story, right? Like, they happen. There's probably other people who quit, and then someone repopulated the mine. They didn't find any gold.
Yeah, it was luck, right? Yeah.
So there's luck. But what I would say is, so the rules of, like, when to quit or not, it's really situational dependent in terms of, like, the actual tactical, you know, situation. What I would say is, if you are intrinsically motivated instead of extrinsically motivated, you will want to do it more and stay with it, right? And by extrinsic motivations are like, I want to get rich, I want to be famous, I want, even like missionary ones, like I want to change the world with this idea. That's an extrinsic motivation. And when things are hard, you're going to be like, oh, why am I doing this? If it's intrinsic, it's like, hey, I'm showing up to work and I love doing this every day. Like, if you love digging in a gold mine every day, you're going to do it even if there's no gold in that gold mine.
That's right.
Now, that might be hard because I don't know if, you know, digging a gold mine might not be easy for everyone. But in a startup, you know, the people who I see that go the furthest, they find intrinsic motivation and joy in what they do. So that could be like, I love to manage my team. I love to sell and talk to my customers. I love to work on the product and engineering. Some set of those things, those are things you have to do in startups. You know, it might not be all of those things that you love, but it's going to be hopefully at least one of them that you love.
Yeah, and you're in good company with that advice, because that's Steve Jobs said the same thing, right?
Yeah.
He said, you have to love what you do, otherwise you'll burn out, you'll quit, you know.
Yeah, and it's not just like, a lot of people say, oh yeah, I love what we do because the mission is to save the world in X, Y, and Z way. And that's very noble, I applaud that. But I mean, like, love what you do every day. Like, what's the thing you're gonna do today that you're gonna wake up and be like, I get to do that? Like, I love to make content, right? And it's like making content, that excites me, energizes me. So I wanna get out of bed and make content.
Yeah.
But if I was doing it as a job and I didn't like it, that would be horrible, right? And I would be very demotivated to do it.
Yeah, I think we're cut from that same cloth on the content side, because I describe it as, I can't not do this. It's like in me, and I need to be able to express myself like this, even though I'm a classic introvert. Like, I don't like talking to big, you know, groups of people for long periods of time. I don't mind public speaking anymore just because I'm used to it, but like being on camera, creating content, sharing with people, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the components that are in there, it lights me up.
Yeah.
And if I don't do that, then it's like, I'm not as happy or fulfilled. So I that resonates with me.
I get it.
Yeah. So you do Justin TV, which allows you to discover
Twitch.
Yeah. You discover this, would you describe it like as a like minimum viable product kind of thing? Like, okay, we want to start with gaming, or we want to start with online streaming content, whatever that looks like. How did you approach it?
Yeah, so it was just talking to the customers, right? We already had the minimum viable product, which was like a streaming and chat service with chat.
Yeah, and you started asking people, what do they want? And they said two things.
Yeah.
They wanted money and they wanted fame, right? They wanted money and love.
Recognition.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it was about building features on top of what we had, which was this streaming platform on Justin TV that would support people in making money and getting more fans.
Yeah.
And so the way this was, we helped them make money was we had like a rev share on the advertising. We did like a partner program so they could rev share on the advertising. And eventually we gave them direct payments where like users could subscribe to their channels and pay them. And then on the fan side, we figured out ways to for them to share and embed their content more places. And we helped them get content, like basically we would schedule them as features on our main page. So like if you came and you were someone we were trying to recruit, we'd give you like, you know, kind of like premium spots, right?
Yeah.
Like TV, right? Like TV will put in advertising for like there are new channels or like new shows and stuff like that.
And that ecosystem though is so complicated. You're describing it with such simplicity, but I'm sure it was so complex to try and come up with a whole, I mean, the whole monetary system, right? Not just how to rev share, but like the gifting aspect and, you know, how to coordinate. That's like a whole economy that you're creating online. That's amazing.
You know, the creator economy where there's direct payments. I think we were one of the first websites like kind of in the West that would do these direct payments from users to the content creators, kind of like Patreon is today, or, you know, YouTube has it now and Substack and all these things. And Twitch was one of the first and really innovated on that idea, I think.
Yeah, but again, if we're gonna extract a lesson, you guys really had your ear to the ground, finger on the pulse, whatever you wanna say. You were listening to your customers and they were telling you what they wanted and you created it for them and you delivered it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we can attribute the success largely to you being a good listener.
Well, once again, I'll give my credit all to my co-founder, but yes.
Your team, you and your team. I'm sure you didn't do this alone, but like that's a really key lesson. I think I talk to a lot of founders. I talk to a lot of people who are running businesses, and I'm surprised sometimes at the order of operations being backwards sometimes.
Yeah.
I hear people saying, I've got this brilliant idea. They rush out to create it without knowing that there's any demand or, you know, any of these product features that people may or may not want.
Yeah.
They even spend money, like, you know, on tooling or, you know, to make dyes or samples, and they spend all this money and then they go to market with it and then they're surprised that no one wants to buy it.
Yes, I think there's this important thing, which is like, you need to talk to your customers.
Yeah.
Just like people are scared to talk to their customers. Like I was scared as a founder often to talk to my customers because, you know, maybe they're not going to say what I think they're going to say. Maybe they're going to say your product sucks. Well, they probably will if you haven't talked to them, right? And so it can be frightening, and it's easier to say, oh, I like know what they want and I'm just going to throw it out there and then they're going to use it.
Well, the question matters too, right? Sometimes asking the right questions where it's at. If you say, what do you think of my platform? That's one question.
Yeah.
But a better question is sounds like what you guys asked, which is,
what's going to get you?
What do you need?
Yeah, what do you need? What are you gonna, what's going to make you stream more?
Yeah.
If you're on another platform, what's going to convince you to switch over to my platform?
Yeah. So while we're on that subject, can you weigh in? Why isn't, here we are in 2021, why isn't Instagram monetized like Twitch or like YouTube? It just seems, well, I think I know the answer, but I would love to hear your input on it. Why haven't other platforms, TikTok is starting to do this, right, with the Creator Fund. But like, what is a downside to directly paying your users?
Yeah, so I think it depends on, like, with Instagram, it's like they have such a specific kind of like addictive product that they don't need to pay the content creators because the content creators want other things from, like, are willing to create the content for free.
Yeah. It's an ad model.
It's an ad model, and they don't need to pay. Maybe it's really hard for people to create competitors, right? With it's kind of like how much is the person coming there for the platform in general, and how much are they coming for the content, right? With content that's more engaging, there it's more that they're coming there for the content, and so those people can bring they have to get paid because they can bring their audience somewhere else. It's like a Netflix show, right? Like if I love, you know, or like The Expanse, for example. I love that show, right, on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
If it's on Amazon Prime, I'll go to Amazon Prime. If it's on Netflix, I'll go to Netflix. I want to watch that show.
Right.
So that show has more leverage. If it's, you know, some random, you know, and with TikTok, it's like it's going to be 60 seconds, so I'm probably not going to go. I'll watch it if it's on TikTok. If it's on Instagram Reels, like, I don't, whatever. I'm just going to go back to TikTok. So TikTok has a lot of leverage.
Right.
So I think that it depends on the leverage of the platform, how much they need to, like, really focus on how much love they show the creators.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And Facebook has this critical mass, right, where they have the biggest platform. It's kind of like a TV. You know, Facebook is TV. So TV has this giant platform. It's based on ad revenue model. They can make it basically for free, knowing that you're going to stay and watch the ads.
Yeah.
Versus, well, YouTube is sort of a hybrid, I guess, where it's becoming more personality-driven.
YouTube is pretty powerful in terms of its distribution, and I think they have a lot of power. Now, they pay content creators, though, right? They will pay. So, like, I feel like the content creators like YouTube, you know? I think YouTube is pretty good. Like, I'm not dissatisfied with YouTube. There's other platforms where the people who are on the platform hate it, right?
Yeah, no, I love YouTube too. I think there's a lot of room for improvement, but as far as platforms go.
What would you improve about YouTube?
I think I would improve the analytics and the metrics. I'd like to understand why things perform and why things don't.
Right, like more deeply.
I would really like to understand more deeply so I could do more predictive, and so I could do more reverse engineering. I feel like I'm asking my audience what you want, and then I'm trying to create that, but the algorithm does not always reward me. It seems sometimes arbitrary and random.
Right.
And it also seems like, well, one of my gripes is that there's this guy, Robert, and then, of course, Susan at the top right. And one of my gripes to them is that they're always rewarding or applauding or boosting or putting a spotlight on the biggest creators.
Right.
And not the middle class or even the beginners.
Right.
Like, they're always saying, you know, to, like, Marques Brownlee, great job on your 10 million subscribers, right? And it's like, you're only celebrating those people. I think you're sending the wrong message.
Right.
It's like, you're only important if you were what I call, like, a super tuber, right? Like, the biggest and the best.
Yeah.
Versus, like, well, look at this, you know, woman here in, you know, the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
She's got this very unique niche channel, and she's talking about really cool things that are inspiring. Those are the people that they should be, I think.
I love that, and I think you're right. I think that, you know, they do it better than other platforms where, like, you know, Twitch, for example, it is hard to, like, grow on Twitch. Like, it is a grind. YouTube has more algorithmic display. Like, my content, I only have like 130,000 subs on YouTube, right? So I just started.
Well, after this, you're probably going to double that at least.
Exactly. So I only have 260,000 subs on YouTube. So I just started. So these, you know, but my content does get shown. It grows regularly, even though I don't have like viral hits in the way of, like, you know, it's not like a Mr. Beast video or something. I gave away a Ferrari or something. I'm mostly talking about advice, right? Advice, you know, which is not that viral. And so, but it's shown to people, it's surfaced to people, and YouTube does a decent job of that. But I agree they could do more to highlight those middle class and beginning creators. And the reason it's important is That's where your next superstar is going to come from, you know? It's kind of like the same thing as Y Combinator, where you're like trying to find young companies started by like two kids out of a garage. Yeah. It's like, that's going to be the next Reddit, Dropbox, Airbnb, yeah. Twitch. You know, if there's an opportunity there. And so for someone else, another content creator, I think TikTok is a good example of that, where they found a way to like let young content creators create, experiment and try around, play around with a different format. Yeah. And they've been, created a whole ecosystem around that.
Yeah, I'll also weigh in my opinion. I think the reason, I think YouTube has an identity crisis. I think they don't know really who they are. I think I know, at least the signals to me, I get an idea of who I think they want to be.
Yeah.
And they failed at it every single time. So like in my opinion, I see them every few years trying to make the leap to Hollywood.
Right.
Or at least to create a bridge.
Yeah.
And back in the day, like when like people like Freddie Wong were creating a lot of content, and they were having people like Ben Stiller or Will Ferrell, or back in the Funny or Die days when that stuff was coming over to YouTube, there was this bridge. You could kind of see things were happening. But then, you know, Hollywood continued to kind of look down their nose at YouTube.
Yeah.
And it became like if you're creating content on YouTube, with a few exceptions, you know, like... Rainn Wilson did a really good job early on, you know, Dwight from The Office, creating his channel Soul Pancake, and it got a lot of traction at first. And he was, you know, one of the Hollywood, you know, popular guys trying to do a lot from, you know, the traditional to non-traditional. And then I think the dream was to cross-pollinate, to have the YouTube stars be on TV and then the TV stars be on YouTube. But it just has never materialized.
Right. I think that that's because YouTube, it's ironic, but I see this a lot with other big companies or is even startups, is like they're in the mindset of the old model, right? They're like success is it's competitive with TV.
Yeah.
And so what does TV look like? And they've tried that in these, like you said, different ways, right? Like first YouTuber, you know, first they were trying to, I think they got a deal with like to put TV on YouTube. And then they have YouTube TV, which is very confusing. And then they have like YouTube Originals, which is like, can we make TV out of YouTube people, right? And charge for it. And what I think is much more interesting is the people who couldn't exist on TV, but they can exist on YouTube. Those are people like me, right? Like my channel is not mainstream, right? It's like startups, it's wellness, it's niche. It's like people who are following me personally. It's like Emma Chamberlain is a good example. Like listening to like a 20-year-old girl or 21 or however old she is just riff on like whatever's going on with her life. And just that is like, no one would ever write that as a TV show or like underwrite it, right, as a TV show. But she can build a 10 million person audience on YouTube, aggregating from all across America and the world. Same thing with Twitch, right? Twitch was like, you know, the video game audience, like putting that on TV, people would say, they tried. It was small, it was too small. So you have to aggregate the internet to make it work. So that's the power of YouTube. And then those people are going and they're saying, it's like a completely different channel from TV. TV is like, okay, we produce it, you know, the production company, talent, they produce it, they sell it to Netflix, it monetizes on Netflix, and then now you get paid some scraps of Netflix, right? Yeah. This is actually interesting and bigger. It's like the creator, like they're the talent, they're the production company, they write it,
yes,
own it, and then they use it to like build their own businesses. And that business can be like I'm a VC who makes YouTube. So my business is investing in companies. I don't care about like monetizing the content.
Right.
If the content is all an ad for my VC business, right?
It's a platform to launch products or services.
Exactly. My friends are launching, who are creators, are launching energy drinks. They're launching membership clubs. They're doing fights, right? They're doing like boxing promoting. They're like, it's everything. And that...
Jimmy has done the burgers, right? He did the hamburgers and...
So to me, that's so much more powerful, actually, than the old model.
Yes. And let me underscore why I think that's true. It's because I would rather have 1,000 true fans who would, you know, rest on my every word than 10 million viewers who were just passively watching, swiping, turning channels, not paying attention. I'd rather have that actively engaged audience when I say, I love this food or I love that book, that they will listen and go do it, then, you know, just this passive listen.
Yeah.
And Netflix is interesting too, because Netflix and Amazon are also playing that vanity metric game. They're trying to win Academy Awards. They're trying to buy talent, right? They're trying to buy credibility. And it's working because they don't have this, they don't have the internet, right? It is like cable TV packaged into programs.
Yeah, and it's distributed on, it's a little bit of a bridge between the internet and the old world, right? They're distributed on Rokus and all this like, you know, smart TVs and stuff, and it's on your phone, like it's everywhere, and they put a lot of money behind it, right? So that's obviously a strategy that works. Like, obviously people still watch TV and movies. I'm just saying YouTube's strategy is a little bit, you know, they're looking at this old thing, but really they have some, they're sitting on a much more interesting gold mine.
That's what I think too. I think that's the difference, is the Netflix, the Amazon, the Hulu, and the, you know, whoever will come next, that is very much, they're trying to become the movie studio or the TV network. Whereas YouTube should really focus, I mean, let's face it, it's probably the 80-20 rule in play, right? Like 80% of the revenue probably comes from 20% of the creators.
Yeah.
But if YouTube would really understand their identity and focus on the 80% of those creators with all that potential and help them grow, whether it's give them better metrics or better understanding or help them, you know, connect, I think there's a big missed opportunity to connect people. It's so hard to collaborate on YouTube.
I think there's, I would look at, you know, if I was YouTube, and I would be like, how many people are being employed by YouTube, like either directly or indirectly, like, you know, me or like you, and like how many people are we employing to make, do all this editing and stuff, and then how many are employed by Netflix, right, and all the downstream of all the productions that they're doing.
Yeah.
And that's like the impact, right? Like that you can, I think there is,
it's probably 10,000 to one.
Huge impact that YouTube can have, and it's international, it's everywhere. Like, to me, and then there's all these downstream businesses that all these people can build, and that is the power of YouTube. That I think is kind of like, I think YouTube is a much more valuable business than Netflix in the long run.
Yeah, and YouTube could potentially do a revenue share by helping to promote those products too if they wanted to. They could get a piece of that.
Build like, you know, kind of like Facebook is building Instagram stores, right?
Yeah.
So that's like a very obvious model, right? But like building ways for to conduct commerce inside YouTube, I think is really powerful. Or like do subscription fan clubs or all these other things that YouTubers are doing.
I mean, we were just sitting back, you know, chopping it up, reminiscing about the good old days and all that. You know, tracking my roots, where I came from and where I'm going. But like I say, man, always said it, it's not about the destination, it's all about the journey. Ain't nothing changed but the weather. The dangling carrot, it hang from the rear view. Your dreams in the past ain't nowhere near you. Backseat drivers got nothing but 2 cents. Shotgun riders too biased, they all liars. I should get an A for effort, I'm too tired. But I'm never giving up, that's why I'm kinda admired. Role model, like it or not, I gotta play it. Sugarcoat the rhyme sometimes, but still say it.